You're listening to the Founder Coach Podcast, a show that investigates what it really means to be the CEO of a fast-growing tech company. My name's Dave Bailey, and I coach founders that raise capital from the world's top venture funds to fuel their business. And I'm sitting down with CEOs to talk about their experiences, the challenges they face, and the lessons they've learned, or are learning right now.
Hello, founders and friends. Today's founder just raised his Series A from Social Capital a few weeks ago. His name is Ev Klinger, and his company Flock is set to make waves in the insurance industry. In this episode, Ed spills the beans on his pivots, learnings, and challenges. Hope you enjoy it. Ed, I'm super excited to be speaking with you. I know your time is in hot demand, given that you've just raised your Series A from Social Capital. How are you and Anton doing?
Personally, we're both doing really well. You know, we started Flock in 2016. I think we had maybe one or two employees when we first met you.
Well, most importantly, you had a much bigger beard back then. What happened to the beard?
Well, we actually, is when we went B2B and started kind of working with insurance companies, I thought I can't really be turning up in these fancy offices in central London with what was at the time, I don't know, 8-inch beard.
Yeah. Well, since then, obviously, you've come a long way. Not only were you two people and a big dream, but your primary focus was drones. And things have progressed significantly since then. So take us through that journey.
So we started as a risk analysis company. Anton and I were both essentially writing university thesis papers on the future of risk in emerging industries like drones, driverless cars, artificial intelligence. We had no interest in insurance at the time. We were writing purely on the topic of risk. So how can you quantify the risk of a drone flight? How can you put a number on the risk of a driverless car doing a specific journey in a specific place? And when we met, we decided to actually quit our respective jobs and start the company because we were both writing about similar things. So I was actually supposed to be starting at Blackstone, a private equity company. I was 1 week from my start date and I quit to jump into Flock with Anton. And Anton was actually a founder of another very successful startup, a company called Fairwheel, which not too recently raised a Series B. Anton founded that product and was head of product there. And we both quit those jobs and we started Flock as a risk analysis company. And then essentially we realized that we could quantify the risk of a drone flight, then you can price the risk of a drone client. So we partnered with insurance companies and we started selling pay-as-you-go insurance for drone flights. And we were the first company in the world to be doing this.
Were you an avid droner at the time?
No, I was more kind of avid engineer and scientist, I would say. Anton and I both became really interested in the drone industry because as now a few years on, it's very clear that the applications of drones have just exploded. You've got governments working with drones, you've got drone delivery companies, you've got drones in agriculture industry. And we were aware of the trajectory of that industry. And we were really curious to understand if our technology could help to improve safety in the industry. And so that's how we got into it. And then we stumbled our way into insurance because we realized that, as I said, if you can quantify risk, you can price risk. And if you can measure risk, then you can manage risk. So really what we do is we help those drone companies measure and mitigate their own risks whilst also ensuring their risks with intelligent pricing.
And at the time, you were taking in data about weather, terrain, all of these different data sources.
Exactly right. We're measuring the risk of every individual drone flight based on its real-time location and the time in which it's flown. So we're looking at real-time weather conditions, traffic conditions under the flight. Are you in an area which is densely populated? The big evolution at Flock, and actually the reason for our rapid growth over the last 12, 18 months, is our expansion into the world of commercial motor. We realized that the technology we had built in drone, this ability to quantify risk and price risk and sell insurance, is actually applicable in a number of additional markets, which are much larger and where the impact that we can have on customers is actually much larger because those customers are so large and there are so many of them. So we expanded into the world of commercial motor fleets and now we're selling to companies like Jaguar Land Rover, for example. So that expansion has allowed us to raise additional funding, as you mentioned, from Social Capital and Chamath over in the US. We're now building out our team. When you and I met, Dave, we were a team of two or three, like I mentioned. When we met a couple of years later in 2019, we were probably a team of 10. Now we're a team of 25. And in a year and a half, we'll probably be a team of closer to 80. So the rate of growth that we're experiencing right now, both from a kind of sales and from a team growth perspective, is unlike anything we've seen in the past, which is great fun, but also obviously a huge challenge.
Do you focus primarily on autonomous vehicles, or do the same calculations you run on risk apply more generally?
So we're selling to businesses not just using autonomous vehicles, but just everyday bog standard driven vehicles. So it opens up a huge opportunity for us to be autonomous ready. Fun fact, we were the first insurance company in the world to recognize an AI as a legal pilot. We are now insuring fully autonomous drone systems, which actually don't have human intervention. And we recognize the artificial intelligence itself as a pilot, and we insure the artificial intelligence. And so you can imagine that logic and that approach being extended into the world of motor vehicles when those motor vehicles start driving themselves.
Oh, it makes so much sense. As you say, it's sort of future-proof because it does seem like the way we're going, it'll be more and more automated. So we spoke at the beginning of the summer and you said, Dave, I'm in the middle of fundraising. Let's talk at the end of the summer. True to your word, you closed the round in that time. So let's talk about social capital. How did you get in touch? What was the kind of journey of the round?
So the journey of the round was great fun. I'm one of those entrepreneurs that actually just genuinely does really enjoy fundraising. For a couple of reasons, it allows you to meet a huge number of interesting, exciting people who have been there and seen it all in terms of the world of startups. But actually the main reason I love it is because it forces you as a CEO to be highly introspective and to look into your company and ask difficult questions, because you're being asked these questions 4, 5, sometimes 6 times a day. They're questioning fundamental assumptions that you have about the industry. They're questioning you on your business model. They're forcing you to really consider whether you have the right team in place to achieve the goals that you're trying to achieve. And that forces you to go away and actually have those discussions internally with your team. And when you're building a business, especially a business that's growing really quickly, it's very easy to get caught up in the day-to-day scramble of achieving targets and launching those features that you said you would launch and hiring those people you said you would hire. And sometimes you need a forcing function like a fundraise that actually encourages you to take a step back and think really carefully about what you're actually working on and whether or not it makes sense and whether the markets you're attacking are the ones that you should be. And there were a ton of learnings from that fundraise.
I want to unpack that a little bit. There is certainly a truth that fundraising is a huge source of accountability. There's something about going to the market that drives even more questions, an even greater need to account for what you're doing. But accountability can often feel very uncomfortable. So for every founder that loves fundraising, there's a bunch that hate it. So I'm curious about the mental models you have around that questioning process, how you stay resilient, because I'm sure you got a bunch of no's as you got yeses too, right?
As a person, I think I'm quite fortunate in that I'm quite naturally resilient in any case. And I think an obsessive learning trait is really critical. And understanding that when you receive a no from an investor or when you receive some harshly worded criticism or feedback from an investor, trying your absolute best to see that as essentially as a gift, because you're receiving that single sentence that says, I don't think this business model works, you might want to try this. Or that single sentence that says, you know, I don't think you have the resources internally to take on this competitor. Why don't you try hiring these kinds of people? It might be an off-the-cuff remark, but in some cases, it's based on years and years of experience. And maybe that investor has seen 20 or 30 similar companies who have made 20 or 30 similar mistakes. One of the things that I did during my fundraise, I will share with you and your listeners, is actually record a huge number of those calls. And I took quite detailed transcripts from those calls. And after every single one of my investor calls, I would document the kind of core learnings that emerged from those calls. And I would essentially keep a tally, and you can start to spot patterns quite quickly. Once you've done 7, 8, 9 calls and you've heard the same feedback 4 or 5 times, you're getting to the point where roughly 50% of the investors you're speaking to are giving you similar feedback. There's probably something in that. The difficult challenge when it comes to this kind of handling rejection piece is you have to balance the ability to take feedback and learn from feedback and make changes off the back of feedback with your own conviction that the way that you are doing things and the way that you are disrupting the market is correct. In my opinion, that's one of the most difficult challenges, because by definition, entrepreneurs of disruptive technology companies are doing things very differently. If they were doing things the same, if they were doing things with an incremental improvement on the status quo, you're probably not going to be building a multi-billion dollar, highly disruptive company. And so you need to balance that acceptance of feedback and that willingness to learn with your own high level of conviction that, yes, you're doing things differently and that's okay. It's actually that difference which is going to feed your growth.
Have you heard of the 10% rule? The 10% rule says no matter what you hear in terms of criticism from someone else, it's at least 10% true and at least 10% of the population would agree with them. It helps you be a little bit more open-minded to try and take that gift, as you said.
talking about recording conversations, one of the advantages is you can start to look at the words that the investor community uses. I run a program on strategy called Clarity. And one of the ideas is the difference between clear and unclear could be a single word or a single sentence. And so when you get to study the words that your audience uses and play those words back to them, it can be very powerful. There's a subtlety in the words you use, I think, and how they impact people.
Absolutely. And actually, there were some really interesting outputs from those recordings. And I'll give you one anecdote. I was speaking with an investor who I really liked, but the line was a bit choppy and then we were kind of coming in and out of contact because the signal wasn't so great. And near the end of the call, there was a bit of a misunderstanding where I thought he'd said something. And then I think he thought I had said something. And it was very unclear to me what had actually been said. And we ended up cutting the call because we both had a hard stop. And I thought to myself, did I just really offend that person completely by accident? Because I think that he felt at the end of the call like I had said that I didn't trust him, but actually I had said something different, right? I'd used the word trust in a totally different context. These situations can certainly play on your mind when you think that you've accidentally upset someone, especially if it's about something as unfortunate as a line which is coming in and out. I loaded up this recording software, which had recorded everything quite nicely, and played it back. I was seconds from sending an email to this investor saying, I think we had a big misunderstanding at the end of that call. I meant this, and actually, I think you heard this. And I listened back to the transcript, and I had a much clearer understanding of what he was saying. And he was actually wholly positive, hadn't misinterpreted anything I'd said at all. And I was just being paranoid and kind of misunderstood what he had said. And so it almost feels like being augmented with this additional technology that gives you extra brain power and listening ability, which is great. I would recommend anyone to get one of these kind of recording tools. Let your counterparty know that you're using it. And it helps you in fundraising, it helps you in sales, and it helps you with internal meetings as well.
That is fascinating. Did you know that a lot of modern psychologist companies offer to record your session so you can watch it back? Because there's research to say that watching back your own therapy sessions is incredibly powerful and therapeutic. And you play it back, you're like, oh, wait, I was on a totally different page in my head. That's really fascinating. And you close around with social capital. Now, Chamath has a reputation for speaking his mind openly and bluntly. I'm very curious what it was like to meet with Chamath and ultimately how you struck a deal.
I personally really resonate with someone who speaks their mind openly and bluntly and directly. I think it just removes a lot of confusion and makes things a lot more efficient. So I love that. Meeting Chamath was a great experience. I mean, he came over to London with his team. Met with Anton and I, got a long lunch. He has a fascinating brain. I think anyone who spends time listening to his podcast can clearly see this. But one thing I would highlight, that it's very rare, is this ability to have this galaxy brain capability whereby you can talk about long-term vision, 15-year plan, what's the world going to look like in 2030, 2040, and you can explore big, scary, exciting ideas. But then in the same conversation, you can zoom in and hone in on a very specific concept, a very specific approach, a very specific policy, and you can talk about that micro detail and with a lot of existing knowledge on that topic, and then very rapidly zoom out again, and suddenly you're back in the room with kind of 15-year, 20-year plans. It's quite an impressive skill. I really, really enjoy that. It's exactly the kind of conversation that I love. So closing the deal, we have a really, really great and close relationship with the social capital team. The thing that stood out to me when we were talking with social capital was a strong alignment across two core areas. So the first is Flock's bigger vision to make the world a safer and smarter place. We want to empower the world of connected and autonomous vehicles, and we want to help the drivers of those vehicles actually mitigate and reduce their own risks. And social capital vision is to essentially help humanity solve the world's hardest problems. And they are really engaged in this enablement of a connected and digital and autonomous world when it comes to transport. So there's a really close alignment there. The second alignment, their understanding and in-depth experience with the world of insurance, the world of drones, the world of automotive. Chamath has all three, right? He's invested in insurance companies, drone companies, automotive companies. He's had exits across those industries, which is incredibly rare. Really, it was love at first sight when we were introduced to social capital. We actually got the introduction through another one of our board members, a guy called Ross Mason, who was the founder of MuleSoft, which sold to Salesforce for $6.5 billion in 2018. Probably one of the world's leading experts in the world of integration.
And founder of Dig Ventures too.
Yes, the founder of Dig Ventures, now a prolific angel investor and now venture investor with Dig, his family office.
I'm glad to hear you know, the round went well. How do you feel having raised it?
You work so hard so that you can get the traction to raise a round. And then you work even harder to close a round. And we have this ongoing joke that on the day we close the round, we always look at each other and say, okay, the work starts now, right? Raising a round of financing is a milestone only in that it allows you to continue to achieve your ambitious goals. That's not to put a negative spin on it. I feel fantastic having closed the round. It's great, right? Like, I'm relaxed, I'm happy, I took a holiday after. And I think it's really important to acknowledge and celebrate these things as a company. But at the same time, we mustn't lose sight of the much bigger story here, which is that we're growing a great company. We want to make the world a safer and smarter place. We want to enable our customers with data and with insights. And so it is a means to an end. And now we've got a whole new challenge. This is where you come in, Dave. I'm going to need some of your coaching, because growing a company from 25 to 80 in 18 months is no small feat. And it comes with its own set of complexities and challenges and so on. So really excited to be getting stuck into those now, actually. It's great fun.
One of the features of a fundraising round, and I think it's one of the reasons why they get a lot of attention, is they're pretty concrete. Once the money's in the bank, there's certainty and completeness that is pretty rare in startups. And you alluded to it, which is that it's actually not complete. It's just beginning. And so the ability to recognize these wins and celebrate them, so glad to hear you're doing a Series A party. You know, I hope you do release parties when you get a big release out and you really celebrate those little achievements, because of course it will never stop. You know, you'll never reach the top of that mountain. And so you got to look back and say, you did pretty well there, man. You did pretty well.
Yeah. The founder of Qualtrics actually talks amazingly about this. There's this kind of constant pressure on founders and on CEOs to always be thinking about the next milestone, the next hurdle. How are we going to get there? And when you get there, you're already thinking about the next one and you forget to celebrate the fact that you got there in the first place. I'm so guilty of this. I'm always thinking about the next hurdle, which I think is important, but having someone there, like a partner, a friend, a coach, to remind you to celebrate the wins when they happen and to say, hey, I know you were thinking about that thing in 18 months, but for the last 18 months, you've been thinking about the thing that just happened and you've been working your way towards it. So take a day or more and celebrate it and take it easy.
Nice. So I have a few questions for you, because you're at a different stage of the business now. And you've been through a lot over the last 5 years since you started the business. I'm curious about what were some of the mistakes you made that you were open to talking about when you were building Flock that have shaped you as a leader?
I mean, there are countless mistakes that we've made and that I've made whilst building Flock. I think that's the first thing to note. One that springs to mind, which has really shaped my approach to leadership and to strategy, actually, is there was a period of kind of 6 to 12 months where we were essentially pursuing two very different business models at the same time. We were selling insurance to drone customers, so we were an insurance provider, but then we were also attempting to sell that technology platform itself to insurance companies, right? We had a kind of direct-to-market distribution, but we were also looking to license our technology as a SaaS platform. We essentially had two different types of customers, one very quick transactional customer that buys a policy online, and one much larger corporate company that has, you know, 18 to 24 month sales cycles. If you think this through, the leadership team at any given moment is thinking about two different business models. And it's really difficult to do two things well when you're thinking about both of them at the same time.
Which of the business models came first?
First, we were selling insurance directly to customers. And then we were approached in quick succession by a large number of insurance companies who actually wanted to purchase that software off of us. And that's how we ended up operating these two business models simultaneously.
So you're operating this transactional business, but at the same time, you were getting these big companies coming to you. So take us back to that moment. What was it like to get interest from these big companies? And what was going through your mind at the time?
We were quite young at the time, right? We were probably a couple of years in. And as you say, the transactional business, the ticket size was essentially a lot smaller. We're talking maybe 1,000, 2,000 times smaller per customer from a kind of revenue perspective. So at the time, having interest from large corporates essentially coming to us and asking us for our technology would have and did represent a paradigm shift in terms of market size and market opportunity and revenue opportunity per customer. So we were totally enticed and really excited by this. We weren't so foolish as to just run at it without thinking, but we were so foolish as to run at it without undertaking a very comprehensive top-down and bottom-up analysis of the market and the opportunity.
How did the board receive this? You know, you say, hey, we've got some big companies and this could be a really big deal for us. What were the kind of inputs you were getting from your inner circle?
So at that time, we actually had great feedback from the board. We take a very collaborative approach to these kinds of decisions. The board said, this is your company. Do the absolute best that you can with the opportunities that you have, but we encourage you to be highly analytical about this and not rush into any decision. And looking back, I wish I'd paid much more attention to the advice that comes from our board members, because like I said about investors during the fundraise process, these are people with decades of experience. They've seen dozens of failures, dozens of successes, and their pattern recognition is really, really excellent. We were in a quite interesting position in that insurtech is a relatively new industry. So there aren't that many templates here. And the board said, you know, that there isn't necessarily one way to do this. This is a brand new industry. We're one of the first companies to really be making waves in this industry. Let's play the game. Let's entertain these discussions and see where they go.
So this really was your call. You decided, I want to go after this opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This was my call. And you know what? I'm actually so thankful that I had the support of the board to do it, because sometimes you just have to make your own mistakes and learn from those mistakes rather than be told not to make those mistakes in the first place. You know, you learn that fire is hot by putting your hand in the fire and you never do it again. And 2-3 years on, I have taken a huge learning from this experience of operating two business models simultaneously. And that learning has worked its way into the highly analytical approach that we take to strategy formation many years later. And I think that I'll take that learning to the grave with me. And so I'm so thankful that the board put their faith in me and Anton and in our management team to go and do this and to try it and to realize that it didn't work, to make some bold decisions, to close that division down, and then to double down on what was working, because it's helped us to become the company we are today.
So when you think back to making the decision, we're going to go into this new market, what were the assumptions that were very logical at the time but turned out to be false?
You're talking about when we chose to expand into the world of SaaS. And I think that the folly there was being overly optimistic about what the complexity of that closing process would actually look like with these very large, traditionally slow-moving insurance companies who provide this actually false sense of security that they're going to go ahead and work with you in this way, often without themselves actually realizing the complexity of the process that they're about to get into.
A degree of innocence there where they're sort of, oh, this should be easy to buy.
Absolutely. And so I think the biggest assumption we made was that the initial positive signaling we got from these customers was an indicator as to the ease or lack of complexity of making this business model work. And that learning is something that we took with us when we made our next expansion, which has been more successful, into the world of commercial motor.
As you look forward to Series A, you mentioned you've got a big challenge because you're going from 25 to 80 people as fast as possible. What are some of the leadership challenges that you are expecting in the next 6 months?
So the first is effective company communication, and I'm talking about internal comms. It's difficult to strike the balance between transparency and intentionality. When you're a small company, everyone in the company is aligned behind one simple, clear mission: get this product to market or get your first few customers. So everyone knows everything, and that's a great thing. But as we grow from 25 to 40, 60, 80 people, it's not the case that every single person in the business needs to be able to access every single bit of information at any given time. And it's certainly not the case that we want to overload everyone with all of that information by forcing them to attend an infinite number of meetings or read an infinite number of memos, bombarding people with extra information and extra data that they don't necessarily need, and which could actually be detrimental in distracting them from their jobs and doing their best work. So I guess my question is how we strike this balance between transparent communication internally and on a need-to-know basis.
What role does communication play for your team?
I think it plays a number of roles, empowering and enabling our internal teams to be building and selling and improving products that ultimately are actually helping our customers to save time and money and lives. We want feedback from the front lines, from the sales teams, for example, to be reaching the product teams. We want feedback from the product teams around when certain features will be shipped to work its way back to sales and to operations, and so that the company is running smoothly and so that we're not overpromising delivery dates, for example, to our customers.
So when communication is happening, feedback is being shared between business units and between people. Also, learning and insights are being shared. If you solve the feedback and learning sharing problem, is your problem solved?
Unfortunately not. A part of that problem would be solved, but then you've got the next layer all around an internal understanding of our direction as a business. It's very easy to talk about what the future looks like and have everyone in the company on board with that vision because everyone's hearing it every single lunchtime. At some point, we've got new staff being onboarded every single week. How do we ensure that these new members of staff are continuously reminded about the longer term vision and direction of the company and excited by that, whilst also having all of that critical business as usual day-to-day communication that they need? So there's that internal balance of kind of longer term vision communication and shorter term day-to-day communication that needs to happen so that people in the company understand where we're going and are excited about where we're going, but have that practical, pragmatic information that they need to do their jobs effectively as well.
Okay, so I've expanded the list. So it's now feedback, sharing learnings, reminding people of the vision regularly, allowing people to have critical information to be able to do their day-to-day jobs. If you did those four things, would your problem be solved?
Unfortunately not, Dave. I'm going to add one more. One of the things we take really seriously at Flock is we have these cultural pillars that we strive towards. We want to be building a culture of ownership, of genuine transparency, which is why I'm talking about this and thinking about this so much. We want to be creating a truly creative environment whereby people are able and feel empowered to have big, bold ideas and make those ideas a reality. And so one element of building a strong and unique culture is regularly communicating that culture, having conversations about that culture, rewarding for that culture and giving praise for that culture, hiring for that culture. And so I'd say that another critical element of effective internal communication is ensuring that everyone in the business understands, knows, and is on board with that culture as we scale.
So the list got longer. We've got feedback, learning, reminding people about the vision, providing critical information, reinforcing culture. As we discuss this, what's becoming clear to you about communication?
I would say that what's crystal clear about communication is that it's probably one of the most important things that a company needs to succeed and scale.
Whenever I hear communication, I always recognize it's a placeholder for something else, because almost every problem in a business boils down to communication. That's how human beings interact, by communicating with each other. So if you want to be intentional about communication, it helps to really pick what we're talking about here. And we've already got five subjects. I'm sure if we had more time, we'd have a long list of different things that you want to be intentional about. Intentional about your culture, intentional about aligning people around a vision and a strategy, intentional about making sure information flows happen at the right time with the right people, intentional about how you treat learnings about customers and about processes in a scalable way, intentional about feedback, because we all know if you're not intentional about feedback, it doesn't happen. There's a certain intentionality against all of these things. There's probably other things too, right? Of those five, though, which is most resonant and most pressing for you right now?
I think the most important is probably the one I gave last, which is culture. Culture is such a permanent force within a company, and taking your eye off the ball there and being unintentional will very rapidly deteriorate the culture of your company, especially in a period of rapid growth. You know, in a year's time, we'll be in a situation where there are more new starters, in air quotes, than otherwise, because we will have essentially more than doubled the size of the company. And so if we drop the ball on culture and don't communicate quite clearly what kind of company we're trying to build, how we want to treat each other, what we think is the culture that we need as a company to succeed and create a really, truly unique and fantastic place to work at Flock, I think everything else flows from that quite naturally, because you have the right people in the right seats. That's the one that I think we can't drop the ball on, and that we need to be really, really hot on ensuring that we're communicating that culture regularly, both in one-to-ones, managers to employees, or in broader team meetings or indeed in company all-hands meetings. It's about building a regular cadence and making sure that we're communicating that culture effectively and hiring for that culture effectively as well.
So here's another question for you. What could you do to influence culture that doesn't involve communicating it?
I think it starts right in the beginning, which is actually before you've hired someone into the business. We test for our core cultural pillars with every single hire that we make. We have questions that we ask throughout the interview process, which are specifically looking for certain traits like creativity, like ownership, like transparency. It's not necessarily the case that we are actively communicating that, but we are searching for it. And we're looking for traits which indicate that this person who we're about to hire is a culture fit, or I think maybe you call it in the past a culture add, is one of those concepts that I'm kind of really interested in. This idea that if you're just looking for people who are rock solid culture fit, then your culture will never evolve. Whereas if you're looking for people who are culture add and who bring maybe a sprinkle of surprise and delight, you might realize that it's a great thing that your culture has evolved, but it's evolved in the right direction. Something else that we do, which I love, is we actually use a tool called Lattice, which has this brilliant feature whereby you can essentially codify your cultural values and pillars into Lattice, and you can give praise to anyone in the company at any time, and you can essentially index that piece of praise against one of these values. So let's say someone has recently had an issue crop up with one of our customers, we miscommunicated something to them accidentally, and the person who was responsible for this did the excellent thing of talking publicly and openly inside the company about what it was that went wrong, why it went wrong, what steps they're taking to mitigate this happening in the future, and how others can do the same. You can then go on to Slack, which is integrated with Lattice, and say, you know, I want to praise this person and I want to index that praise against this value. And everyone in the company can then celebrate this amazing thing that this person did of being highly transparent, in that case, was the cultural pillar, by sharing their mistake and sharing their learnings internally. One, I think it's great to celebrate these moments and to reward people regularly within the company, especially when they're doing such fantastic work. And two, it continuously reinforces and re-messages this idea that transparency is something that we take seriously without necessarily forcing us to, as a leadership team, continuously communicate it. It's almost built into the day-to-day practice of using Slack and responding to meetings and so on.
I love that too. It turns out that communication is a relatively weak lever to influence culture. These are great examples. You can recruit it, actually hire and fire for it. You can attach positive labels and praise it and celebrate it, role model it, all sorts of different ways to enforce these cultural elements. But there is one communication technique I can share with you, because it takes literally less than 10 seconds to implement, that is actually scientifically proven to nudge people's behaviors. And it's leading questions. So what's one of your cultural pillars?
Creativity.
A leading question around creativity might simply be, what are you going to do this week to embody creativity? Just involving those pillars in the assumptive leading question is actually very powerful, because you know the power of questions, right? They open up a space in someone else's mind. If you keep asking the questions, eventually they're going to stick.
I love that. I'm reassured by the fact that essentially every founder and CEO you speak to who's scaling a business at any stage earmarks this as one of the critical pieces that they're trying to figure out. It's a relatively new concept in that rapid growth, blitz scaling, scale ups have to reinvent the way that they do communication every 6 to 12 months.
There's been a big shift in the way almost all companies that were not remote first do communication in the COVID age because of the importance of written communication. I think a lot of companies are really embracing that. And even companies that go hybrid actually still need to be a written communication first company. And so that requires a certain rigor and skill set that we're all getting used to. For example, I think we've all learned by now, never give sensitive feedback using text. So text has its limitations, right?
I'll tell you another tool I fall in love with is Loom, actually.
Oh my, Loom. We use it every day. I did 2 Looms before this call, actually. What do you love about it?
I love how instant it is. It's incredibly easy and quick. Immediately provide feedback in a thoughtful way without, as you said, dumping in a text or in a Slack message. I love that it allows you to screen first rather than face first. So you get all the value of seeing someone's face as they talk and react. And I love how asynchronous it is as well. So this idea that you can provide that kind of detailed, nuanced feedback to people across 3 different time zones and have them all see and react to the same feedback over the course of 24 hours is absolutely fantastic.
We have adopted it in a major way. I found the team love it. I found clients love it. I find everyone loves it. It's just a much more human way to communicate, isn't it? It takes a little of the pressure out of writing that email or writing that Slack message, because there's tone, you know, there's all this sort of nonverbal stuff. And you can watch it in 2x speed, which is great.
As people will probably watch this podcast.
Are you a 2x? You might be a 2.5x. What are you?
I know I'm up to 2.7 on some books.
Oh, man.
If you're listening to like Balaji, you have to listen at 0.5. You know, Balaji works for A16Z. He speaks at a relatively slow pace, but the density of information that he packs into his sentences is absolutely astronomical. So yeah, I'd recommend you go and spend some time listening to him.
I will certainly do that. There's a few books that I feel the same way, where they're just so dense with knowledge. The one that immediately comes to my mind is Rory Sutherland's Alchemy. And my approach isn't to listen to it slower. It's actually to re-listen to it multiple times. So I keep it on the probably 1.8. I used to be 2x and then I realized I wasn't really listening. So I'm back to 1.8. Do you ever read books twice? I've read Alchemy 3 times, for example.
I'm reading Blitzscaling for the second time right now. And actually it's funny because the first time I read it, it was much more theoretical because we weren't in the process of blitzscaling. And the second time I'm reading it, it's much more practical. It's more like a guidebook because we are in the process of blitzscaling. Another book I've read is The High Growth Handbook by Elad Gil, which if I had to name one resource for a startup founder to have on a desert island, it would be The High Growth Handbook. It really is a genuine handbook on how to build a high growth company. And it touches on everything from hiring to firing to building an exec team, a board, product market fit. I mean, you don't read it end to end. You just go to the chapter that you need at any given moment, but everything you need is in there.
Nice. Well, Ed, look, thank you so much for joining. What was it like to come on the pod?
Great. I really enjoyed it, Dave. Very conversational. I like the free coaching. If you send me an invoice after this, I'm going to be really pissed off.
Yeah, exactly. No invoice. We'll have to get something in the calendar, and we're actually moving house, so might be looking at your neck of the woods. But anyway, why don't we get something in the calendar and meet up, have a beer?
Very exciting. I am absolutely up for it.
All right, great to have you on.
Good to see you, Dave.